We'll hear argument now in the case of Tanner against Jupiter Realty Corporation. Mr. Moorman.
May it please the court, I'm Chris Moorman. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, an appeal from the trial court's grant of an employer defendant's motion for summary judgment in a public policy wrongful discharge case. Briefly, the plaintiff alleged to have been terminated in retaliation for opposing unethical business practices of his Chicago-based commercial real estate employer. The plaintiff was an asset manager. And the trial court granted its motion basically on its finding that under the Illinois choice of law analysis that Georgia substantive law, which does not allow for the tort of retaliatory discharge, applied to the exclusion of Illinois law, which does allow for the tort. And before addressing the choice of law issue, I want to touch quickly on just a couple of things. The first point is that there is very good evidence in this case that Jupiter Realty, the defendant, improperly siphoned off and withheld funds from its publicly traded lender, GE Capital, which Mr. Tanner brought to light and opposed. And that secondly, there can be little doubt that when Mr. Tanner was dismissed from Jupiter Realty on June 25, 2003, which is a point of contention as to the exact date, that was in direct response for his having raised and opposed the company's conduct towards its lender.
Under your view of the tort of retaliatory discharge, shouldn't anyone informed of a termination immediately engage in whistleblowing activity? And would that then transform that termination to a retaliatory discharge?
If one were looking to try to create a cause of action where it didn't otherwise exist, perhaps that would be the conduct that the law would inspire. But however, in this case, and that's why I wanted to address the fraud issue first, that's not the case. That's what that's the picture that the defendant paints, but we've got a Rule 56 standard here.
But I don't see where the fraud is, really. I mean, certainly GE Capital was fully authorized under the loan agreement to request all information relevant to determining the amount of the tax holdback, whether it was $1 million in sum, whether it was $2 million in sum, whatever it may have been. So there's no reason to think that this is, you know, some little mom and pop organization that wouldn't fully protect its own rights. Secondly, in terms of how Jupiter was going to use the money, as I think maybe you've conceded, I'm not sure, maybe, but as your opponents point out, they owed the taxes. You know, whether from a cash flow point of view they used that money for the time being for one thing or another would have been a matter of supreme disinterest to the Internal Revenue Service. They would have said, when the tax bill is due, pay. And I don't see any evidence in this record that Jupiter was engaged in tax fraud.
The fraud, Your Honor, had to do with a violation of the loan agreement.
But why is that a violation? Where's the violation of the loan agreement?
The loan agreement, just to run through it briefly, the loan agreement, which was for a $52 million loan, gives GE Capital a lien on the properties in this portfolio.
Sure.
And it's Mr. Tanner's job to make sure that Jupiter lives up to its obligation. When a lien property is sold, the loan agreement allows for that property to be released,
right,
if certain conditions are met. And the key thing is that, you know, the money flows through Jupiter.
Well, I know, and there's a holdback,
right,
of the taxes, and nobody's saying that the tax was zero on this property. So as I was, that's why I began with the amount of the taxes. The loan agreement, section 2.3E2 little 2, gives GE Capital the authority to request whatever information it wants to evidence the amount of income taxes that are held back. So if GE Capital is disturbed when it's $2,691,320.20, GE Capital can say, we would like to see the background documentation.
Certainly they
and,
can.
And I mean, this is, doesn't even get to the point about the fact that, you know, Mr. Tanner is paid through the end of, through the July 25th date, and that all of these things happened in Georgia. I mean, we can get to that in a minute. But I just have trouble sort of at the very outset seeing exactly what his problem is.
If I can get right to that, the Mr. Tanner's concern centered around the waterfall document, which broke down how the assets were, the
right, and let's assume for the sake of argument that this was an accurate amount of a tax holdback. If it was an accurate amount of a tax holdback, I don't see what interest it is at all of GE Capital whether Jupiter wants to, you know, buy CDs with it, or whether they want to invest it in the stock market, or whether they want to buy new properties with it, or pay their taxes with it, or anything else. It becomes Jupiter's problem.
Except that the problem is that Jupiter has overestimated what its liability should be.
That's a different issue. So it's not a question. And that's the issue that GE Capital is fully entitled to protect itself on.
They are, but I don't think that the fact that they did not, and in a situation where the relationship goes back and is one of trust.
But the waterfall document is an allocation document. It's not a gross computation document. And Mr. Tanner's initial dispute was an allocation dispute.
Until corporate controller Rob Eschenbrenner uses that waterfall document, which the evidence is that he did in fact so use that document to compute the partner principal profit in this deal. So the problem is that GE Capital's not getting out of the deal when these properties close what it's supposed to get, because Jupiter has, in breach of the agreement, held more back for what it's calling tax liability than it should
well,
have.
It's going to have to pay its taxes. You agree with that, right? I mean, it
sure.
has to, whatever they put on these waterfall documents or anything else is not really terribly important. The IRS will figure out what they owe in taxes.
Sure. And again, the fact that the IRS may not have come down or may not have come down yet, or that the lender hasn't reacted in some way, would not be dispositive. The fact of the matter is, Jupiter doesn't have an explanation for why it didn't subtract out its initial basis in these properties, which their corporate controller admit should have been done when calculating what their earnings were on these properties, and therefore, you know, multiplying that by whatever the 30% holdback number to get to that number. The other point I would make, Your Honor, is that the fraud doesn't have to be proven to a certainty. He just has to prove that his belief that it was occurring was reasonable. And that's, you know, that's one of the points about the retaliatory discharge tort that's articulated.
Yeah, assuming you can get to Illinois, that's right.
And maybe I'll spend just a moment on that. I know I'm running out of time. And this is a situation where, frankly, under the context that we have, it could probably go either way. You've got a plaintiff that is living in Georgia, working for an Illinois-based company. His main contacts are with Jerry Ong, one of the Illinois-based partners.
That's not who he reports to, of course. He reports to the vice president of the Atlanta office.
Well, in terms of who he reported to in the office, it was to Kevin Moyer in Atlanta, correct. But his work was supervised and controlled by Jerry Ong here in Chicago. He sent the email by Moyer, while Moyer, the email that which caused him to raise his concerns, while Moyer was in Chicago. Jupiter is headquartered here. Four or five of its six principals live here, pay taxes here. His work is directed by Mr. Ong, who lives here. The decision to terminate Tanner is made during a multi-party cell phone conference that took place while Jerry Ong was in Charleston with the others who were in Chicago. The waterfall spreadsheet, as we've talked about to some extent, was used by corporate controller Rob Eschenbrenner here in Chicago to calculate partner payouts, and that, we submit, is exactly the moment when the fraud occurs. And then lastly, and it's a point I've already made, the fraud which Mr. Tanner brought to light was for the economic benefit of the Chicago owners and partners. And so we submit that, you know, it could go either way, but what we really think it boils down to is that Illinois has a legislative scheme that specifically deals with corporate financial crime in a way that Georgia does not. And that's cited in our brief. And the public policy is enunciated in the legislative declaration that a substantial burden placed on the economy resulting from the rising incidence of financial crime is a matter of grave concern to the people of Illinois. And although Georgia may have a similar interest in punishing corporate wrongdoing, nowhere in our law books is that interest stated so vociferously. So here, the public policy implicated in this case arises from a given source, Illinois statutory law and jurisprudence. And because the main goal of the public policy exception to the at-will doctrine is to protect the public's interest, Illinois courts are in the best position to apply and have the predominant interest in applying Illinois law as against an entity that's headquartered in Illinois. And my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moorman. Mr. Widman.
May it please the court. Summary judgment was proper in this case for several reasons, the first of which is that Georgia law, as Mr. Moorman stated, does not recognize retaliatory discharge, applies here. This is a tort.
It's an awfully close question, isn't it?
I disagree, Your Honor. I believe if you look at the most significant relationship test as it's applied to retaliatory discharge cases, all of the factors support the application of Georgia law. The first is, where's the place of injury? Well, plaintiff worked and lived in Georgia. He lost his job in Georgia. In a retaliatory discharge case, the place of injury is therefore Georgia. The second factor, place of injury causing conduct, is also Georgia. And as the French case, which this court decided, points out, the place of injury causing conduct is not necessarily where the termination occurs, but where the alleged whistleblowing activity occurred. Here, that was in Georgia. Mr. Tanner sent the email from his office in Georgia, and the conduct that he complained about, he also reiterated in the car ride to Mr. Moyer while they were in Georgia traveling to South Carolina.
On the other hand, you have the main decision makers, the main office in Illinois, the people in Georgia who are in constant communication with the Illinois people. You know, the discharge decision was made in South Carolina and in Chicago via the phone. But be that it is, I'd like to ask you this. Assuming that Tanner is correct and that the defendant was engaged in an effort to defraud another company, are you arguing that there's no public policy interest in assuring that financial transactions are not fraudulent? In other words, would it matter if consumers rather than a company were the target of the fraud?
Well, I think the case law is pretty clear that private disputes over accounting practices that do not rise to criminal conduct, as is the case here, do not implicate public policy concerns in Illinois. And this court has stated that on more than one occasion, and that the mere reporting of financial violations of financial regulations which don't involve health or safety or the welfare of individuals does not constitute a clearly mandated public policy. But even assuming that it does, let's say that Mr. Tanner did engage in this whistleblowing activity, what he can't avoid is the incredibly...
What state are GE's headquarters?
I believe they're in Connecticut, but to be honest, don't know.
Anybody thought about the application of Connecticut law? I mean, one would think that if there's an interest in protecting victims of potential fraud, it would be the domicile of the victim.
Well, but this is a retaliatory...
I can understand Georgia law. I can understand Connecticut law if that's GE's domicile.
This is a retaliatory discharge case, Your Honor, and at issue is whether... my client retaliated against this alleged whistleblowing activity by discharging Mr. Tanner. And I don't know that where GE is domiciled really has any bearing on that.
Well, no one has suggested that it does other than me, but one would think that Connecticut, if that's the home state of GE, has more of an interest than Illinois.
Well, regardless of what state law we apply.
Of course, I never understand this interest analysis. I bet I could whip up a claim for any of the other 47.
You raise an interesting issue, but quite frankly, regardless of what state law you apply, what Mr. Tanner can't get around, what he can't overcome, is the incredibly obvious and simple failure to show a connection between his whistleblowing and his termination. He was terminated before he made any complaints. He was not terminated in June of 2003. He was advised, he concedes he was advised, on May 27, 2003, that he was losing his job on July 25, 2003.
So your position is, as long as he's paid until July 25th, the fact that he's told you can't go to the office and you have to pack up your belongings and march out, there's no kind of dignitary harm or anything that he could recover for that period?
There very well may be dignitary harm here, but it's not
harm.
I mean,
I can see that there's no financial impact, according to at least what I understand from the record.
There is no financial impact, and I believe that's undisputed. But the point is, this is not a Title VII retaliation claim. This is a retaliatory discharge case. Mr. Tanner needs to show that there's a causal connection between his whistleblowing and the decision to discharge him. He concedes the decision to discharge him preceded his alleged whistleblowing activities. And to the extent that this constitutes some sort of adverse employment action, as in a Title VII retaliation claim, as we said in our brief, that's not actionable here. There really is no causal connection. But even if you get around that, and if the court finds that there is a causal connection, we've shown that the conduct, that there was a legitimate non-protectual reason for the discharge and his paid leave. With respect to the discharge, the office was closing, and the only reason he was terminated was because of his dwindling portfolio and the fact that it didn't require a full-time job. And in fact, Mr. Tanner testified that he knew that the reason they were driving to Greenville, South Carolina, was to hand over and transfer his portfolio to another portfolio manager. So there's a non-protectual reason for the decision to discharge him. With respect to the decision to tell him not to come back to the office, there's also a legitimate reason for that. Mr. Tanner testified that he advised Mr. Moyer that he had retained a lawyer, that his lawyer advised him that he had some basis for a sexual harassment claim, but more importantly, he told Mr. Moyer that he stole Jupiter company documents. And that was one of the reasons that the Jupiter principals, on their conference call, decided, let's keep this guy out of the office. We think he poses a security concern.
I wasn't clear. I mean, those statements appear in your brief, but what I wasn't clear on is whether they were properly contested at the summary judgment stage. Are those conceded, or do they remain unanswered when you
filed? Those are conceded. Mr. Tanner is the one that testified to that. So mm-hmm. Mr. Moyer did as well, but those are not in dispute.
Okay.
So we've clearly shown valid non-pretextual reasons for the discharge as well. But really at the heart of this case is the fact that the decision to terminate him, as the district court found, occurred prior to his alleged whistleblowing, if it even amounts to whistleblowing. And because of that, he cannot show this causal connection. He cannot show the nexus. And for that reason, summary judgment was proper. And if the court has no further questions, I will stop.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Moorman. Your time has expired. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case is Conrad against Barnhart.
Thank you. May it please the court, in this case, the district